Hey guys, welcome back to the Coda Cutter Podcast. This week we're talking to polyglot and YouTuber Lindy Boats. So she speaks a bunch of different languages, but she's most proficient in Korean and Japanese. And today we're hoping to get a closer look behind her journey with Japan specifically, because she's also lived there as well. But besides that, we're also starting a new format, starting with this episode. In terms of this audio podcast that you're listening, it's going to be exactly the same. But on YouTube, we're going to have a video portion of the podcast where you can actually see our faces. And we're also going to be editing down the podcast to maybe 10 to 20 minutes of the best parts. So definitely go check that out and subscribe to us on YouTube if you're interested. Anyways, hope you guys enjoy the podcast and thanks for listening.
Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to the Coda Cutter Podcast. My name is Raza, and I am joined by my co-host, Eric. We talk to people of all types of backgrounds about their lives in Japan, studying Japanese, or even tips and tricks on how to learn the language. This week, we're joined by a very special guest in Lindy.
Yes, so Lindy is a polyglot YouTuber and graphic designer who has been posting videos for many years now, starting with videos in Korean to her learning Japanese in a multitude of different languages. And she's lived in many different countries, such as South Africa, Pakistan, United Arab Emirates, Japan, and now she lives in Singapore. And she mostly makes videos about language learning on her channel, but today we're going to get a closer look behind her journey with language learning and Japan. So, Lindy, can you give us a quick background of who you are and where you're at today?
Sure. My name is Lindy. I'm South African. I'm currently working as a UX designer in Singapore. And before that, I lived in a few different countries, including on and off in Japan. And my favorite thing to do outside of design is learn all the languages.
All the languages. So
how many languages is that?
Not all of them yet. So there's like 7,000 languages in the world, but I speak like 0.3% of that. No, I've been learning Korean for about 12 years now, and that's kind of what spurred me on to learn Japanese, in the sense that they're quite similar grammatically and vocabulary-wise. Mm-hmm. They both stem from Chinese, so there's Korean, Japanese, and Mandarin that I speak a bit, and then French, and I recently started Spanish. My home language is Afrikaans, and I'm actively learning Hungarian and dabbling in Tagalog and Vietnamese.
So how would you rank like your most proficient to least proficient?
Probably, okay, well, English and then Korean, Japanese, French, Spanish, Mandarin, and all the others kind of trail off after that.
Dang. I see. So the way you started, I was interested. I thought we were about to have the first person on the podcast to speak all 7,000 languages.
That's the goal. Just kidding.
I think most of them are like dialects of like each other or something.
What do you mean? For sure.
Like within Chinese, there's so many different dialects, right?
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so you said you got interested in like learning languages through Korean.
So I had a lot of Korean friends when I lived in Dubai, and when I moved back to South Africa, my mom saw an ad in the newspaper for free Korean lessons, and I was like, what is this, like, another weird idea of hers? So I just tried it, because at that point, I'd only ever taken, like, Urdu, Arabic, and French as school subjects, so I never thought of language learning as, like, a hobby or something you can do outside of school. But once I took Korean and visited Korea and became more fluent in the language, I think one of the ways I sort of discovered the Japanese language, not like I didn't know it existed, but became more interested in it, is because a lot of Korean artists release Japanese versions of their songs. Mm-hmm. And I listened to a few and I was like, oh, this sounds really great. And I'm noticing like a few similar words. And I just started dabbling in it. I had a friend who, she used to teach me how to write katakana. I think we were in like grade 7, and we used to pass notes to each other, which we wrote in English, but using katakana. We thought we were like super, like no one can understand what we're doing. It was terrible. I would cringe if I had to read that now. But yeah, I guess Korean was kind of the entryway into like more self-study languages for me.
Yeah, kind of going back on how you said you started learning Korean and then you got fluent in there. fluent in Korean? Like, what was the actual process of, like, becoming fluent in Korean?
So that's kind of up for discussion because everyone has a different definition of fluency. I think that it's like a lifelong journey learning languages. You're never going to get to a point where you're like, okay, I'm done, I can move on, right? So I'm not sure if I would consider myself like 1,000% fluent in Korean, but I'm definitely, you know, comfortable enough to be able to work in a Korean company and so forth. But the concept of fluency aside, it's definitely a long process. I think we're so used to instant gratification, and we watch a lot of YouTube videos of people like, you know, learning this language in 3, 4, 5 months and I'm fluent, and we kind of expect it to take less time than it actually does. And what we don't see is the process behind it. So Korean, it took me a few years to feel, you know, comfortable and confident enough to speak without stressing about not knowing. But the process was a lot of immersion. I was constantly, everything I watched or listened to or read was completely in Korean. And I used quite a similar process for Japanese. I was grateful enough for the opportunity to have been able to be in Japan for most of my intensive Japanese studies, which wasn't the case with Korean. But it doesn't matter if you're in the country or not, as long as anything you consume is in that language. So you could be a complete beginner, but the more you constantly hear things, the more you're going to be starting to recognize words, improving your pronunciation. It's just a lot of immersion.
Right. Do you find it to be like encouraging or discouraging knowing how long it takes to learn a language? Like, for example, when you started learning Japanese, I'm sure you knew like how long it would take for you to become like competent in the language. Did you find that like encouraging or discouraging?
That's a really interesting question. I would rather say it's more realistic. Like, I felt like, oh, this is a reality check. But I think this whole polyglot culture only came online in the past decade. Before that, people didn't really like rush to learn languages or prove anything, right? So when I was learning Korean, I didn't even think like, when am I going to be fluent? So when I was learning Japanese, I did have the idea that, oh, this is probably going to take a while, but I never really saw it as a rush. However, there were like a lot of moments where I felt, oh my gosh, can't I be fluent already? So I did my internship in a Japanese company, three Japanese companies over the span of 2 or 3 years. And of course, there were points where I'm like, I have no idea what they're talking about. I wish I could be more fluent. Or I felt so... what's that? Imposter syndrome. I was like, I can't believe I'm here. Like, I can barely speak enough to give a presentation. It was a lot of like fake it till you make it. But I think that acts as like motivation in itself as well, right? Like, hey, I'm here now. Let me make the most of it. Even if I'm sucking now, I'm still going to try and use this as an opportunity to get better.
Mm-hmm. So were those internships like in Japanese mostly?
Yes, completely. The first one I did, no one at the office spoke a word of English. The second one, it was kind of like a little bit, if I was stuck, I could speak a bit of English. And the third one, it was an international advertising agency, but everything was done in Japanese. But if I needed to, there was English as a backup.
So does that mean like when you went to Japan, you already were like pretty competent?
So my parents lived in Japan for 4 years, and I visited there during my university holidays over the span of that time. So the very first time I visited Japan in 2013, I could barely speak. And then the last time I was there, like 2017, 2018, I was a lot more comfortable. So my very first internship, I don't even know how I did it, but the last one, I was way more comfortable. I could do all my presentations in Japanese.
Nice. So... Did those internships like make you more interested in Japan, like the culture and everything?
Definitely. So because I'm a designer, I've always been interested in, you know, design from different countries. I'm working in UX right now, but I was always interested in advertising, graphic design, and packaging. So when I lived in Japan before my internships, I would always go to these exhibitions, these graphic design exhibitions. I was like, oh man, the quality of this is amazing. The attention to detail, the Japanese graphic design style, it's just so different from anything I knew. So I kind of set my sights on knowing that I would do internships as part of my degree, let me see if I can get my Japanese to a level good enough to be able to do my internships in Japan.
I see. So it was like mostly you were still like focused on like just the like graphic design side of Japan while you were there, or did you explore like other cultural things like anime or songs?
I love music. I am really a big fan of a lot of Japanese music. My playlist on Spotify is super long. I remember like sitting in front of the TV watching the music channels and like writing down the names of all of the songs I liked so I could go look them up on YouTube later. I'm not really personally interested in anime a lot, which is a funny story, because one of the clients I had when I was doing an internship was One Piece. And I remember my boss saying, we have a new client. Do you know what is One Piece? And One Piece is like either the anime or it's like a dress, like a woman's dress. Right. So I was like, yeah, like a dress, of course. And he's like, no, the anime. I'm like,
I remember learning that and being so confused.
I know. So I had to go home and like, I don't know why, who made it on Memrise. There was a course for like One Piece vocabulary from the anime. I was like, this is like exactly the resource I need. So I was like, give me a plot breakdown of One Piece, teach me everything. And I spent like 2 days just trying to learn about the anime. It was crazy.
That reminds me of the times I would be in high school. You have to read a book and then you get tested on it the next day.
Oh my
just
God.
Go look up the summary.
Yeah, on Spark Notes.
Spark, exactly. Oh yeah, bringing it back. I mean, I definitely would say One Piece is the more fun version of that, though, for sure.
Oh yeah,
I would love to. I wish that was what I was learning in high school.
That sounds like an effective
analyze One Piece
effective Japanese class. Like you gotta watch the whole season and then summarize it the next day or something.
And I think you learn a lot more when you're under pressure too, right? So if you're kind of just self-studying on your own, you can impose pressure and deadlines on yourself, but it's definitely not as effective as knowing like this is the real world and this is an internship, and if I don't know what I'm talking about, I could lose this.
So did you have like going back to like Japanese songs, do you have like a favorite Japanese song?
Not a favorite song,
or maybe like one that you're listening to a lot like recently.
Oh my goodness, let me open my playlist. I can't think at the top of my head. They find an artist or two. Oh.
Maybe it's like top two album recommendations that our listeners can go home and listen to for homework.
Hiraidai. He writes his name in like English letters, Hiraidai. He has this like Hawaiian feel to his music. Very chilled, very tropical. And I also like Iri, I-R-I. It's like very dreamy feels. So those are probably the two artists that I've been having on repeat a lot. And then one last one, if you really like someone with a strong, unique voice, Taichi Mukai. I think many people might know him. He has a really cool voice.
I see. The Korekara listeners are going to have a lot of new stuff on their Spotify after this podcast. I'm excited. I'm going to have a lot of stuff on my Spotify too. So
nice.
It's going to be interesting out
maybe,
here.
Maybe if your Spotify playlist is public, we can share it and people can go listen to it.
Oh yeah, for sure. It is. I'll send you the link later.
Okay.
Sounds good.
So did you go to karaoke a lot?
No, I am a terrible, terrible singer. So I've been, but it's a scary experience. I think if you're like more confident, I'm kind of on the shy side.
Right.
So I guess I should have just sort of let it go and just enjoyed it and stuff. But it was hard for me because I know that I'm completely tone deaf.
Right. But I think like with a lot of Japanese people, they don't care. Like they're tone deaf. They
That's
know
true.
They're tone deaf, but they just like love singing.
That's true. Like karaoke is like part of a nomikai culture. You know, if it could be rude if you don't go and enjoy it. So there's a whole thing of like honne and tatemae. Like even if your boss has the worst voice, you have to be like, you're amazing. You have the best voice. So I guess no one would have really cared if I had broken their ears.
Yeah, don't worry. I've done it a couple times. I've been there, done that. Tone deaf life. But speaking of the Novikai culture, I mean, you've been through a couple of internships over in Japan. How would you say that was for you? Because you said you're mainly Japanese companies, not very much English leeway you could really go off of. So how was that like?
The Nomikai culture specifically?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that was, I'm not sure if I would say it was a culture shock because I knew about it before, but actually experiencing it and the frequency of how these Nomikais happen maybe every day or every week. At first I was like, oh, this is cool. You know, like we're all hanging out after work, there's snacks, there's drinks. But I still don't really drink a lot of alcohol. And I just thought it was an awesome opportunity to be able to mingle and practice my Japanese. But I started getting concerned, like, are these people sleeping enough? Are they spending enough time with their family? And I remember walking to the office one morning and my coworker was wearing exactly the same outfit as the previous day, sitting in the same spot. And I was like, did you go home? He's like, nope, been here since yesterday morning. It's tough. They work really, really long hours.
Speaking of like long hours, do you think those are productive hours or do you think there's a lot of like looking busy sort of stuff going on?
I wasn't gonna say it, but you asked, so yes. Again, I can't, you know, generalize a whole culture or company, but definitely from my experience, it's working slow. Now, slow could be a good thing. It could mean you're extremely detailed, you're avoiding problems, but things move very, very slowly in the company. And if you're naturally a fast worker, you're gonna have to slow yourself down. And like you said, look busy. Decisions can't really be made unless there's a whole panel of people who agree on it. It might be a bit looser in the design industry where you have a bit more creative freedom, but I was, it was new and interesting for me to figure out that like, wow, you know, the entire company has to agree on this single packaging design. I remember the feedback I got after my internship was, you are an incredibly fast worker. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, because it could mean you are like hasty and not detailed, or it could mean like we're so used to working very, very slowly and it's amazing how much you can get done when you don't look busy. But I think it differs from person to person. The most important thing, though, is to be respectful to the culture you're in, right? I can't go in there and be like, come on, guys, you're slow, or, you know, I had to adapt to that. So I had to be like, okay, they've given me two tasks for the week. I cannot finish both of them in one day, even though I technically could. So how can I space this out and live as they are living or work as they are working and not kind of bring my own ways or ideals into an already established situation?
Did you have any go-to things to do to kind of make yourself go slower, kind of take up some time?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Decrease the mouse speed. That's so smart. Well, maybe my like brain speed was decreased because everything was in Japanese, right? So if I was like on Photoshop, all the controls and stuff were in Japanese. So of course I had to like slow down to read a bit. So maybe I was lucky.
It was all part of the language learning process,
I guess. Definitely, definitely.
I mean, speaking of the language learning process, you mentioned that you kind of, you didn't really speak much Japanese like the first time you went to Japan to visit your parents. Yeah. So kind of, how did that kind of evolve? Like, how much did you know when you first came? And around when would you say you kind of learn more and more to, I guess, like a proficient enough point where you felt comfortable?
I don't think there's a point, at least during my time in Japan, where I felt confident in the sense of like, I can do anything. I read this quote, let me see, I think I wrote it down here. More often than not, being brave means doing it scared. I feel like that was the setting for a lot of, I mean, I did a ton of interviews there for the internship. I was paranoid for each interview. So I don't think I probably reached a level good enough to be able to communicate, but there was always that feeling of, am I going to make a mistake? Am I going to, you know? So like I said, at the start of this, it's always still like a long process to learn a language. So I can't say I'm, you know, 1,000% fluent. But I would say there came a point maybe after the 2 or 3 year mark when I was like, you know, I can do this. I can go out on my own. If I get lost, I would be able to find my way home. I'm, you know, it's not really part of Japanese culture, but if a stranger were to come up to me and say hi, I would be totally okay to talk. The very first time I went to Japan, I just knew the basics, like how to introduce myself, how to say where I'm from, how to ask how much something costs, you know, like any beginner course Japanese textbook level. And you only really understand the nuances of the language and the culture once you've either been there for a while or immersed it in a long time. So concepts like I mentioned earler, honne and tatemae, or just cultural nuances that you won't learn in a textbook, those take a while, a few years to get used to.
I see. And I mean, speaking to those, I mean, you told, you spoke about how long you spent learning Korean before actually going there. A lot of it was self-study, right? So were you able to pick up those cultural nuances by yourself then through immersion?
Sorry, could you ask that again?
Oh, yeah. So you mentioned these cultural nuances, right? And of course you had learned Korean for quite some time before Japanese, and you're talking about how you can find out about them through either living in the country or immersion. And you talked about how deeply you immersed in Korean. Were you able to find those nuances through immersion before you had the chance to go visit Korea?
Oh, we're talking about Korea now. Sorry, I got confused there.
I was just talking about the cultural nuances, I guess.
I think it was quite a different experience for both Korean and Japanese. So Japanese, I learned a bit, and then I went to Japan, and that's where like the most of my immersion and studies really happened. For Korean, I was always surrounded by Korean friends and the Korean community in South Africa. But that's like a Korean diaspora. It's not, you know, you're not in Korea. So learning these cultural nuances, it kind of depends on the situation. So in Japan, you have, at least in the working culture, you have specific spaces where you need to stand in the elevator, for instance. You know, if your boss is with you, you're at the back, or it's different angles you need to bow at. How do you give your business cards? You put it under the other person's. All of these things you learn in specific contexts. Those weren't really things I was needing or experiencing when I was learning Korean with my friends as a high school student, for instance. So I may have learned like different cultural nuances at a different pace.
I see. So I guess moral of the story for Japan, you have cultural geometry.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you spoke about the interview process, which I mean, with that, like not even thinking about languages and your language learning at the time, that's very daunting, especially in a Japanese setting where you go into a room and you're faced with a panel of judges basically, and they just make
down.
A judgment
you
on
can't sit down, until, sit down. Until they say please sit.
Well, what was that entire experience like for you, just in terms of the experience?
Every single time it was nerve-wracking. I don't know if I just had more guts as a university student. I felt like I had nothing to lose. Let me try. It was scary. Number one, like you said, because I was not fluent. I was like, I could stumble over my words. One time, I forgot the name of the person I'm talking to. And in Japanese, you can't just be like, dude or sir or you over there. You have to use their name plus san, right? Like, you know, Takashi-san or something. I didn't know his name, and I had to be like, I'm so sorry, I forgot your name, because my brain was like freezing up. I was so nervous. The other time, my pants ripped. So it was like, sometimes it was just comedic and terrible. But the more you do it, the more you get used to it. And I would say overall, it really helped increase my confidence. It taught me a lot of vocabulary relevant and specific to my interests and my career. So I'm very, very grateful for all those opportunities.
I see. And I mean, how many interview rooms did you end up walking into over that period?
Probably 15. So I went through like email and CV kind of screening processes first, like maybe 100 emails. Out of those 100, like 80 were answered. 20 of them maybe ended up in interviews, and then three or four internships.
I see. Wow. What a breakdown. And I know you have a couple of videos outlining that, so anyone interested should go check out the whole process leading up to your breakdown and what went down over there. But I mean, it's really interesting hearing what you were, I guess, the emotions that you were kind of going through at the time, because I mean, obviously interviews in any sense, any culture, anywhere you go are going to be daunting to a mm-hmm. degree, especially when you don't have much experience or it's like the first job. It's very, very tough. And I mean, going out of your comfort zone, being kind of scared, like you mentioned, is always interesting to see and really good to hear about when someone else is thinking about going and doing that themselves mm-hmm. to kind of get some extra courage in terms of finding what they want to do next. And I mean, you've had a lot of moving around in your life, packing up bags, kind of moving your life here and there, back and forth, multiple countries. Mm-hmm. And I mean, now, of course, you're in Singapore with many languages racked up in your head by now. But would you say having that experience of being able to move around and being able to adapt kind of helped you in your language learning pursuit?
Yes and no. I do acknowledge that being able to live in a lot of different countries, I was exposed to more languages than I would if I had just, you know, grown up in South Africa my whole life. But nothing is impossible now with the internet. Like, for instance, I've never been to Hungary. I barely use my Hungarian textbook, and I'm still learning the language through apps and online tutors and friends. Like, you can do anything even if you're not living in the country. But I, you know, before all these language apps were there, I was, you know, living in a few different countries, but I didn't really take language learning as seriously as I should have. But the exposure and the curiosity to languages was definitely there. I had a lot of Filipino friends when I was growing up, so I was always interested in, you know, learning new phrases from them. And it was only till much later in this year when I actually started learning Tagalog seriously. So I definitely think it piqued my curiosity for sure.
I see. And I mean, of course, learning these languages, Japanese is just one of them. I mean, it takes a lot of time and effort and planning, scheduling. And a lot of our listeners are currently studying Japanese and really in the thick of it. So I guess during your time, especially when you were mainly focusing on Japanese, how would you say your kind of time breakdown was? How much time were you spending? How much was it immersion? And how, I guess, what were your kind of study habits at the time?
I think it depended where I was. So if I was back in South Africa at university, of course, I had to focus most of my time on my projects. So I would study Japanese probably only on weekends or sometimes at the library. If I was studying for a art history exam, I would take a break and go through some Japanese. I would read a few flashcards on the way to campus. But when I was in Japan, I would spend a lot more of my free time. When I was not going out and exploring, I would be at home studying. So I think immersion mostly came from Japan, just, you know, being on the subway and hearing it, or buying a sandwich at the convenience store and having to use the language. The more you're exposed to that over the span of a few years, you're going to learn a lot faster. I always say that I learned Japanese much faster than I did Korean because I was in that environment. But you don't need to be in that environment. You can create it for yourself. So back when I was in South Africa, I would just find a textbook that I really liked and try and work through a few chapters a month. I would divide the book up, see how many chapters there were, and decide by when do I want to finish it and split my time up there. And I also made it fun for myself. Like, I downloaded an app where you could do like a little live stream or radio broadcast in Japanese, and that way I got to practice it and still make friends and have fun and have people call in and we could talk together in Japanese. So if you find something you enjoy, it makes it a lot easier and faster to learn.
How did you tackle like reading and writing Japanese?
That was hard. I kind of dabbled in it a bit when I was in high school, so I could read a tiny bit, and it was just repeating it over and over. I'm not sure I had the best method back there. And each of my family members has a different method of learning it as well. So my younger brother just did everything on Memrise, and he had, you know, they have these, what do they call them, memes, where you can create like some, you know, if the word sounds like this, that's how you'll remember it. So he just learned the entire hiragana and katakana through one single website. Maybe that worked for him, but not so much for me. I want to be able to like write it on paper. So I just love writing things. So I kept a diary in Japanese. And even if I didn't, like, if I don't know how to write something, I'll go look it up at that moment. So in my moment of need, of needing to use that word, I would look it up. And that helps you remember it more the next time. Like, oh, last time I couldn't remember it, so I better remember it now, sort of thing. So forcing myself to use it helped me remember. And of course, specifically to learning hiragana and katakana, it's just writing entire words. You get bored if you write, you know, kakikukeko, mimimimo, over and over and over. So once you start writing entire words, you're going to remember it faster.
Right. And I mean, one thing is, one very tiny thing I love from your videos is that you always mention to go back to your notes. Don't just write it down and then forget about it.
Well, I have to practice what I preach sometimes. It's hard to go back to your notes and review it. I feel like I learn a lot more when I'm tactile, like holding a pen or walking around. So if I go back to my notes, I either have to like re-highlight them or hold something in my hand, because it can be boring just reading a single page. So.
Right. I see. And I mean, another really interesting story I liked was that your dad would go and bring you kind of the survival Japanese section of the newspaper to help you learn some Japanese words, kind of help aiding you in your Japanese pursuits. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was really sweet of him. I don't think I have it with me now to really see what it was called. I think it was, there was some section in the Japanese Times where they would give a little dialogue, a theme, and some kanji practice. And he brought it from work every week. And I would cut out that piece. I would stick it in my diary. I would highlight the words I didn't know in the dialogues. And then the kanji where they show you how to write it step by step, I would write that out over and over and over, because it's very important for me to remember the stroke order and get my hand used to it for the muscle memory. I wouldn't say the resource itself was like incredibly useful. It's what you do with it, right? You could use like a packet of chips and, you know, read the thing at the back and then highlight the words and put it in your notebook, right? You can use anything. So I wouldn't praise the resource itself, but it was just like a nice fun weekly routine. Like, I knew dad was gonna bring the newspaper, I could like cut it out and do my studies. It was a nice little routine that kept me going.
Yeah, you love to hear that. I mean, it's kind of funny that you mentioned the bag of chips. Imagine just being a master at reading the nutrition facts in Japanese, the main thing you do. Yes, masters at every facet of Japanese. Maybe someone in the comments could become one of those. Let us know. Help us decipher the right things to eat the next Japan trip. And I mean, we talked about culture shock briefly a little bit earlier, but I mean, of course you went to Japan, and a lot of it was a lot of intrigue initially before you actually had the chance to travel there. But when you actually got there, what were some of the other things that kind of just shook you after spending so much time? I mean, of course, a lot of time in South Africa, but many other countries as well.
I would say the attention to detail. Everything is planned out to the last minute. Everything is accounted for. Everything is on time. It's amazing. My dad and I used to make a joke when the train was more than a minute late, we'd be like, oh my goodness, this country is falling apart, because it's so rare for even the train to be a single minute late. Another funny story is we were waiting for a bakery to open. There was this really nice donut shop that opened near my dad's office, and they said they open at 10 a.m. So we were there like loitering around at 9:48 because we had just stumbled across it, and we saw everything was ready. They were standing at the counter. You know, we could have walked in, but it was 9:49, 9:50. Time went on. They weren't even like cleaning or preparing. And my dad got so impatient. I was so embarrassed. I'm all for like, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. My dad is like, come on, like they should be open by now. And he was standing there like waving at the door. And I was just cringing. I'm like, Dad, just wait until 10 a.m. As soon as it turned 10 a.m., They were like, you know, ignoring our antics at the door. As soon as it turned 10 a.m., they were like, "Irasaimase, welcome, you know, let's get some donuts." Yes! I was like, it's amazing. You can see there are customers outside. You literally have nothing else you need to prepare. But 10 a.m. is 10 a.m. So it was on time. Until 10 a.m. Yeah. It was amazing. They put so much detail and effort into anything. If you buy a package, you could buy some socks and it'll be the most beautifully wrapped pack of socks you've ever seen in your life. Everything is taken very seriously and with a lot of attention to detail.
Yeah, I think in Japan, like any hobby or craft you can think of, you can find like a Senmon Ten. Like yes. Someone who's just devoted like 20 years of their life to doing something very niche.
Yes. And you'll find like niche little stores for everything. I really like trains, and I think Japan is the best country to be in if you're like densha otaku. So there's like a store right. where the entire floor is just train merch. You can buy the jingles from the train lines. You can buy videos of the footage, the scenery of the trains. You can buy merch of the train stations. So I was like, oh, this is really train heaven. Where else in the world will you find this?
So is this the reveal on the Korekara podcast that Lindy is a big fan of trains?
Yes, it's true. My apartment here in Singapore does look out over a train station. And when I saw that, when I could see that I can see the train line going in and out, I was like, yeah, this is it. This is where I'm going to live.
It was all part of the plan. Yeah. I mean, how much train merch do you have? That's the next question that just came up to my mind.
It's now. Like the camera turns back and it's like, oh.
It really it's would just all train like merch that. Everywhere. Oh my gosh. I have my backpack next to me and all of the little tags that hang off are like train station names in Japan.
Do you have a favorite train station then?
I really like Shin-Okubo in Tokyo because that was Koreatown. So it's like a nice like, hey, this is like a familiar language and food, but it's still Japan. I was like, well, Shin-Okubo is like the coolest place in Tokyo for me. And then I also have our home station. We used to live on the Ginza line in Aoyama Ichome. So Aoyama Ichome tag is also there.
Oh, nice. Oh, I mean, those are great stations to pick from for sure. Very, maybe I'm getting into trains now.
When I was in Japan with like a previous guest, Jack, we were trying to like memorize all the train stations on the Yamanote-sen. And then, yeah, there was like, most of them are like really obvious because you see them a lot. But there was like, there was like a few where it's like super hard to memorize. Like the name was really long. So we made sure to like go there and have like some memory there so that we remember it. And I remember we went to like Egui Sudani just because it was like really difficult to remember the name of the station. But yeah, now that I remember it.
That is so cool. It's also the most crowded line during rush hour.
That's the part about the Yamanote line I do not want to remember. Very packed, very warm.
Ooh.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever been on it when it was like max packed, like pushing up against anyone.
Yeah, consider yourself lucky.
I wish I could forget.
Same.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting that we talk about trains, though. I mean, this is very interesting to me because as a part of the podcast that it's been a while since we have talked about trains on the podcast. Actually, we did have an episode where we talked mainly about it. And
oh yeah,
I gotta go listen to that as soon as we're done.
I think it transitioned right to something else.
It had a hard transition. I don't know how it happened, but I think it was the whole idea of Japan and technology, and we were talking about trains, and then somehow we just got into toilets because, of course, as the prime foundation of technology in Japan, you have the Japanese toilet with the whole remote on the side, every possible function necessary.
Machine learning.
That was the best, man. I kind of miss that, you know, in winter. There's nothing more you want than a warm toilet seat, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's a luxury.
Opens. It just opens. It knows when you're there. Hi. How's it going? Just opens.
Oh, the machine learning is insane. Never will I forget such advanced toiletry, but
it actually
says the toilet. Please no. I don't want my toilet talking to me.
Exactly at 10 a.m. when it opens.
Oh no.
It like buzzes. It's like, where are you? It's like an alarm.
You're off schedule.
Oh, we're giving the toilet industry too many ideas here. We should be compensated. Oh my goodness. I mean, I guess one part of, I guess it's not much of technology, but one part about Japan that you've gone on record talking about that you really love, and I guess it just wherever you are in general, is books and books and books. And I mean, you've been known to pick up many books wherever you go. So I remember watching one of your videos, and the first time you had a chance to be in those bookstores in Japan, you got a lot of books. And were there any books in particular that really have stuck with you to this day that you got in Japan?
So most of the books I bought were graphic design related, right, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, that it's just on a different level. It's amazing. So I learned a lot about the history of graphic design in Japan, the key players back in the day, and then, you know, what are the companies and agencies to look out for now. So they have these graphic design manuals every single year, where every design company or person has a page, and there's even their contact details on it and a portfolio. So that's actually how I made a lot of my connections in the design world in Japan. It's just by contacting these people. So that's definitely something that, if I had to choose like one book that has sentimental value for me, it's one of those design manuals. But what I really like about Japanese bookstores is you can find a book on anything. And it's similar to what you were saying earlier, Eric. You can find someone who's interested in any kind of hobby, right? So there's books about like types of pens, and books about like how to wrap presents with brown paper. You know, the most specific book ever you will find there. I really, really like that. And magazines even, like subscription magazines on how to improve your handwriting or how to bake European bread every month of the year. Like, it's crazy. I love that they have such particular books. You can find anything you're looking for.
Did you have a favorite book about trains?
No, that's a flaw in my plan. I don't have any books on trains yet.
Yet.
Allegedly.
Looks like we have a homework assignment now, yeah. Lindy. That's really interesting, though, kind of how deep and detailed these books are, especially for design and kind of your career trajectory. And I mean, you mentioned Japanese design several times now, and I mean, what was maybe one of the specific things that really got you interested in Japanese design when you first saw it? Like, what are some of like the distinct factors that really makes it stand out compared to design elsewhere in the world?
It's hard to put it into words how different the style is, but you can see some stylistic differences between, like, if you just look at poster design, for instance, and compare it to most Western graphic design throughout the decades, you can see there's a distinct different Japanese feel. It might be more minimalistic or more geometric, or the way they use typography is different. That was always interesting for me to see as poster design. But I think what really got me interested in this, I have to give credit to my mom. So she's really interested in art, and we used to live near a few art museums. And when I visited Japan my first few times, when I was, you know, catching up with my family, she was like, okay, well, tomorrow we're going to go to this exhibition, and the day after we're going to go to these exhibitions. And I think we went to like 400 design exhibitions throughout the years there. And she would just like find them. And there's this one museum, for anyone who is interested in design, who's going to Japan soon, hopefully after the pandemic, there's a museum called 2121 Design Site. They're at Tokyo Midtown.
Roppongi.
Incredible. The architecture is stunning. The quality of the exhibitions there. There's really like advanced technological themes. There's graphic design, there's technology. It's so stunning. So that was probably the one museum that really got me like, wow, you know, Japanese design is where it's at. I went to
like a cockroach museum hosted by that company.
Really?
Yeah, it was so insane. It was like the most insane museum I've ever seen. It was so cool.
Disgusting and intriguing.
Yeah.
At 2121 Design Site?
Yeah.
Wow.
They had like a huge cockroach leg that you would walk in and see, and it's like all hairy. And then there were like places with like just like household supplies, but they would hide like a cockroach in like the corner.
That's so cute.
And then there was like a fan where if you walk near it, it would like shoot some air at you. So it would feel like a cockroach like landed on your body.
That's smart. Wow.
Yeah, I wonder what the whole thought process was behind the inspiration behind that. I'd be I don't know what I'd be thinking if I felt that on me.
One of the exhibitions I went to, there was a Meiji exhibition. So they had like a huge model of a carton of Meiji milk, and they showed like all the different packaging styles over the years. And I don't know if you know those little chocolate mushrooms, like Kinoko no Mori.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, they're my favorite snack. They had a big like dissected chocolate mushroom in the center of the room.
Wow. How big are we talking?
Bigger than me, taller than me.
Oh my god. Wow. That's pretty interesting. I mean, I feel like the exhibitions is very detailed and very outside of the box. Whatever you think you're going to see when you go inside, you're always going to be blown away with what happens to be there.
That's
very
true.
Creative. Yeah, and I mean, I think it was one of the more interesting parts of Japan where you don't really know what to expect sometimes, and you're always kind of, I wouldn't necessarily say blown away, but kind of interested, especially if you haven't spent time in Japan before. And I wouldn't necessarily say it's a culture shock, but I mean, it's a lot of interesting things that you'll just find just walking around exploring, right?
Yeah. I think people are also intrigued by the just seamless, how well old and new works together there. Japan is incredible at preserving their ancient history, architecture, cultural practices, but they're so technologically advanced at the same time. So you have this really like cash-based, paper-based society, but they'll be, you know, manufacturers of the most advanced technology at the same time. It's very, very interesting how they combine old and new in Japan, and both just work.
Yeah, I'm never going to get over the fact that they still use fax machines.
Yes, it's wild.
I'm going to assume that your internships use a lot of fax machines. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You must have been thinking like, oh, why? What is that thing doing there? Why am I seeing that right now?
Yeah.
Relic of the past.
Like I said earlier, sometimes you just have to stop questioning and just accepting. I remember getting to a point where the first few times I was in Japan, I was like, this place is incredible. Everything is new. Everything is amazing. And then near the like last few times I was there, near the middle, I started questioning like, but why? Like, why do they have fax machine? Why won't they open at 9:49 a.m.? You know, why can't I use this point card versus that one? And then you get to another point where you're like, you know what? It works for them. I can see why. This is why their country is so successful. So it kind of went from like fascination to like, what? Confusion to just acceptance.
To the it is what it is.
Yeah.
Five stages of grief.
This is what you're bound to experience in Japan, I guess. Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned the 949. Looks like you've kind of got to the point where your dad was at that one moment before at the bakery. you've understood why he was waving now.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Just needed one of your friends there to cringe at you, I guess, to go full circle to continue the process.
Yeah. It's a fine line between, like, being respectful of how the Japanese people do something, and for them it might be absolutely taboo and wrong to stray from their rules. Yet for other people it might be like, come on, like, just be practical or, like, open up a little bit. But the way they do it has been working for them, and that's why they're so successful. So you have to get to a point where you're like, who am I to, you know, change the way they're doing things? I can question, but I should always remember that I am a guest and I have to be respectful. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably a very important takeaway for anyone kind of visiting another country. I think that's always the most important thing. You're always a guest there, and respect the culture. And I mean, at the same time, learn so much. There's so much to learn, so much to enjoy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, hopefully pandemic eases up so everyone can go experience that a lot more coming up soon.
Hope so too.
You gotta hope for the best. And I mean, you spent a lot of time in Japan previously, but of course now you're in Singapore working in UX. But have you ever thought about maybe deciding to have a return to Japan and ever living there in the future?
Definitely crossed my mind a lot of times, but I wonder if it would be a very different experience, because previously, you know, that was home for a long time. That's where family was. And now I would be alone there. I mean, I don't mind. I've lived alone for 7 years, but the whole experience would be very different from sort of the Japanese experience I had previously. The working culture is also something to get used to. The long hours, the nomikai, the hierarchy. So it also depends on the company that I would work at. Nothing is like impossible. Like you can ingrain into any culture and any working style, but I'm not sure if that's what I'm looking for in my career right at this moment. But I was hoping I could visit Japan a lot of times for holidays now that I'm in Asia, but it has not worked out that way yet.
Hopefully soon.
I know how you feel.
we're all hanging in there.
And I'm also curious, like, what do you think of, like, working culture in Singapore versus Japan? Because it's also, like, a big Asian city.
Yeah. I think one of the first things I noticed, maybe not directly related to working culture, is people are way more casual here. And I think it's to do with the weather. Like, people come to the office in flip-flops and shorts sometimes. Okay, but I do work at a startup, so it's not the same as, like, I don't know, the financial industry. So that was interesting for me. Like, I dressed up really fancy when I went to work in Japan. But here I can go in, like, flip-flops. Because it's hot. So that was different for me, like, just the way people dress. And of course the language is different. In Japan, the Japanese language has different levels of formality, so you almost feel like your whole working environment is a lot more formal, whereas here there's Singlish, which is so much more chill. Yeah. Like it's funny, it's short, it's fast, it's punchy, which is completely the opposite of the formal Japanese working culture.
Yeah, it actually feels more like more chill than normal English. It's like, yeah, normal English is more formal than theirs English.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean Singaporeans don't work hard. It's just funny how they kind of combine both seamlessly. You could be in a work meeting planning out, like, your feature that you need to ship next week, but you'll be like, okay, la, we just do it tomorrow. Like, you just have this, like, very informal way of speaking, but you're talking about a very serious topic.
But I mean, it's really interesting kind of having all this experience kind of working in different cultures, different environments, and kind of seeing different aspects of different cultures. And I mean, that's one thing that a lot of our listeners really like and kind of want to kind of take part in themselves. So we were kind of wondering, Lindy, do you have any advice to any of our listeners who are interested in maybe the whole traveling to, I guess we can talk about Japan specifically, or maybe studying Japanese?
Yeah, maybe we can start on the sort of traveling thing. I would recommend just doing your research beforehand about cultural practices. There's a lot of, you know, sometimes tourists on the train who speak extremely loudly, and that might be normal for them, but it's really disturbing when in Japan everybody's used to speaking softly on the train. So small things like that, even just a simple Google search can tell you what to expect in terms of cultural behaviors. It doesn't mean you have to become a different person. It just means be respectful of your host country. So I highly recommend just like looking at, like, you know, taking off your shoes. Some people might not know that that's a thing you do over there. And it can really make your experience so much more delightful when you are respectful. People are going to be more open to, you know, chatting to you. And the Japanese are very, very friendly and hospitable. So even if you do make cultural mistakes there, they're going to forgive you and they're going to be nice. But I recommend from your side also just researching what is acceptable. Then language, what did you say? Language learning tips?
Yeah, and we can maybe talk about Japanese specifically too.
That's tough. I mean, everybody learns a language differently. I guess on that note, try not to be overwhelmed by the amount of resources there are out there. There are so many textbooks and apps and methods, even just compared to 5 or 8 years ago. And I think people spend a lot of time trying to think, what's the perfect way to learn Japanese? What's the perfect app I need? But just start somewhere. Even if you have just one app or one book, stick through it and rather stick to that, because you're going to waste your time trying to plan out the perfect method instead of just starting with something. And keep at it. It's going to get hard. Japanese is not an easy language. It gets very frustrating when you get to kanji and you're like, why is this read in 5 different ways and not one? But try and keep in mind why you're learning in the first place. It always helps to have a goal in mind, whether that be, you know, wanting to travel to Japan or having Japanese friends or wanting to understand subtitles or not watch with subtitles when you're watching anime. As long as you have a goal in mind, be consistent every single day. Do it in small steps. Don't give up, even if it gets hard.
Very great words of advice coming from Lindy here. And I think on that note, I think it is a good part to close out the podcast here. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, Lindy. We're very honored and really enjoyed our conversation here today. Very fun, lighthearted, and I mean, always love talking to you over here. And what can we expect coming out of you, coming out from you soon over here with your YouTube? You have your website, you have a lot going on. So what can our Korekara listeners and new Lindy fans over here come to expect soon?
Yeah, well, I try and release videos once a week, so you can definitely keep expecting videos on my language learning progress. I'm always happy to do like book and app reviews as well. So if anyone wants to recommend an app or something I should check out, I like doing those. Otherwise, I continue posting my tips on my blog. And most of my content is very like based on what people want to see and want to recommend. So if people want to see more Japanese content, just hit me a DM or an email and I'll get to it.
Perfect. And I mean, speaking to that, where can everyone go and find you, Lindy?
Sure. Well, my website is lindybotes.com. That's LINDIBOTES. And on Instagram, it's also lindybotes. Twitter, lindybee. And then YouTube, you just type in lindybotes, you'll find my channel.
Perfect. We got every avenue to find Lindy. So you guys have no excuse now. And with that, at the end of our podcast, we like to have a little fun message called the message to the Korekara listener. Is very creative name, I know, but it's usually it can be anything from a fun little message, Japanese proverb, a shout out, just a short little message. It could be anything. So Lindy, I'm going to be putting you on the spot right here to close out the podcast. What is your message to the Korekara listeners?
Oh, it's going to sound cheesy, but just like keep going with your Japanese when it gets hard, and remember why you started in the first place. And it's always There's a famous quote from Kato Long, who's a Hungarian polyglot. She said, language is the only thing worth knowing even poorly. So even if you just know three words in Japanese, it's still going to change your experience and your life so much more. Everybody's going to be so much more welcoming to you. So even if you feel like you're struggling, it's not for nothing. Keep going, and it's Japanese is just going to change your life.
You love to hear it. And with that, we will catch you on the next one. Thank you guys for listening. We'll see you later. Peace.
Bye.